Hello, this is Karen Fresco with the News Gazette dated Wednesday, July 29, 2020. We begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Illinois Impact. Vermilion County sets another new single-day high for cases. Region's positivity rate remains low, 2.9%. 6 days after reporting a single-day high, 12 new COVID cases, Vermilion County topped it. The 14 positive tests announced Tuesday included 5 teens and 5 residents in their 60s and give the county 41 active cases. 41 of Champaign County's 55 new positive tests involved residents of Champaign-Urbana, including 12 in Urbana's 61802 zip code, which has now an area high 42 active cases. County hospitalizations were up 1 Tuesday to 13. Despite 9 straight days of increases, the 7-day positivity rate for Region 6 of the state's COVID-19 mitigation plan, which includes every area county, was just 2.9%, better than the overall state rate of 3.8%. 4 long-term care facilities in Champaign County and 3 in Ford County are classified by the state as having COVID-19 outbreaks. 2 or more cases that are active, any new cases in the past 28 days. The Champaign County facilities include Gifford's Country Health and Rehab, 4 cases, Savoy's Champaign-Urbana Nursing and Rehab, 4, Savoy's Reflections Memory Care, 30, and Savoy's Villas of Hollybrook, 2. Bars and parties linked to rise in COVID-19 cases. Champaign slaps one bar with temporary shutdown. By Deborah Pressey and Ben Zigterman, Champaign. Parties and bars are at least partly to blame for Champaign County's largest ever daily jump in COVID-19 cases, health officials said. The county chalked up 55 new cases Tuesday, with Champaign-Urbana Public Health District Administrator Julie Pride saying at least part of the spike is the result of large gatherings, conduct in bars, and people acting like we're not in a pandemic. Part of the increase can also be linked to catching up with lagging data, she said, though new cases have been on the rise. Champaign County has had 20 to 30 new cases a day for a week, with much of the increase resulting from parties, gatherings, and bars, Pride said. One downtown Champaign bar was already penalized this past weekend, partly for failure to comply with reopening safety measures. Mayor Deb Finan, also the city's liquor commissioner, issued an emergency order of closure to Styx Arcade Bar, primarily for non-compliance with the state's Phase 4 operating guidelines for bars and restaurants, Deputy Liquor Commissioner Matt Rochley said. The bar was ordered to be closed from 6:30 p.m. Thursday through Sunday night. No other liquor establishments were subject to an emergency order of closure, Rochley said. The health district has received many complaints about bars and has had many positive cases linked to people being in bars, Pride said. One solution being discussed is that bars should only be open if people must remain seated and follow restaurant rules, she said. Clearly, allowing standing and movement within the bars is not working. It is not safe. That, however, is still allowed at this time. Pride said the health district will have teams of inspectors going out to bars between midnight and 2 a.m. to look for violations and will be relaying information to city and county liquor commissioners for action. We are looking with the cities and liquor commissioners to ensure that there are consequences for bars that do not follow the infection control guidelines, she said. These will include fines and potential suspension of liquor licenses. The community can help by not patronizing bars that are not following the rules. They are not safe, and we have already seen multiple outbreaks in bars and many cases with links to bars. Styx owner Justin Taylor said he met with the city Tuesday. We had a good meeting to talk about any issues they had, he said. Then I got a chance to ask questions. Hopefully, we won't have any more issues moving forward. Taylor said there was some confusion about the city's rules and expectations. Now we have a better understanding of what the city is asking of us, Taylor said. We want to be in compliance. He also said the city received a couple of complaints against Styx, and he and city officials discussed how many people would be allowed in. The bar has had hardly any business since it first opened in February, Taylor said, so I'm not quite sure where those complaints came from. Habitat for Humanity. Mother of three thankful to become homeowner. Move-in day for 115th recipient. By Deborah Pressey, Champaign. The path to home ownership hasn't been easy for Saida Smith, but all her hard work is paying off. The 31-year-old medical assistant worked two jobs and paid off her debt to prepare for a big day today, moving with her three kids into the first home they've ever owned. This morning I was crying in my car. Thank you, God, I did it, she said Tuesday. Smith was set to move into the 115th home built by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County, a four-bedroom ranch on West Eureka Street in Champaign. It's one of just a few homes the group expects to complete this year. Employed at Francis Nelson Health Center's Behavioral Health Facility, Smith grew up in the local community in a blended family of 10 kids. She got her certified nursing assistant certificate and went to work right after graduating from Champaign Central High School in 2007. Her first job out of school was with the former Illini Heritage Nursing Home, now Illini Heritage Rehab and Health, where she was CNA coordinator, then the activity director. After that, she worked for the former Community Elements in group home settings. One of her cousins, a social worker, first encouraged her to apply to become a Habitat homeowner. You don't know if you're going to qualify unless you try, and your kids need a home, you need a home, she recalled. To become financially ready to buy a home, she returned to work at Illini Heritage Rehab and Health and continued her day job at Francis Nelson, she said. A young mom with three children before she turned 30, Smith said she also found time to homeschool her kids while schools were closed this past spring. Her oldest daughter, Janiyah Henderson, is 13. Her second daughter, Jida Henderson, is 10, and her son, Joel Brown, is 4. Smith said her daughter's father, Damian Henderson, was her high school sweetheart. They were together for 8 years before he was murdered in 2014. A few years later, she also lost a brother to gun violence, she said. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, she said. Her kids were very excited about the move to the family's new home, Smith said. As they get more excited, that does something to me emotionally, she said. Anybody who knows me knows, if nothing else, I'm a great mom. Along with her work and parenting responsibilities, Smith has also been responsible for taking on Habitat's required 300 hours of sweat equity for new home buyers, part of which includes working for more than 100 hours on her own home. Habitat home clients must also make a down payment and demonstrate both a need for affordable housing and an ability to take on an affordable mortgage. Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County Executive Director Chad Hoffman said work on Smith's home had already started when the coronavirus pandemic began. If not for pandemic-related delays, it would have been completed in the fiscal year that ended June 30, he said. With volunteers in much shorter supply in recent months, Hoffman said he and other Habitat office staff members pitched in on construction. Habitat typically builds 5 to 6 homes a year, but expects to build just 3 in the new fiscal year that began July 1, Hoffman said. Homes are typically sponsored by businesses and church groups, but 2 business sponsors dropped out this year, he said. That's been a challenge for us to secure funding, but individual donations are up, he said. Another house, this one on Harvey Street in Urbana, was begun in July with the help from a grant through Thrivent, and Hoffman said he hopes churches will come together to continue the sponsorship. With Habitat's thrift shop, Restore, closed for several months and now reopened for just 4 hours a day, Hoffman said the organization's biggest need is for donations to help move its mission forward. He'd also be grateful for prayers. I believe in the power of prayer, he said. Volunteers are beginning to come back to building projects, and the organization is doing all it can to make building sites safe for everyone, he said. Not being able to accept as many people into Habitat's home ownership program this year will matter, Hoffman said. There isn't enough affordable housing to go around, and rents continue to eat up too much of family incomes, he said. Apartment rents, people are spending well over 50% of their earnings just to have a decent place to live, he said. Helping make Smith's home build possible was funding through the Yahoo Employee Foundation and the Urbana Home Consortium, plus volunteer labor, according to Habitat. Brand new Habitat houses are typically celebrated with in-person dedication ceremonies with the families moving in. But for safety's sake, amid the pandemic, Smith's new home will be marked with a half-hour drive-by celebration starting at 5:30 p.m. today. Smith and her immediate family will be out front, and well-wishers are invited to drive by, wave, and hold up signs. Return to school. Back-to-school plans taking shape late. With August just 3 days away, Arcola School Board members will vote tonight on the draft of a reopening plan that Superintendent Tom Mulligan characterizes as not complete yet, but it includes many components. Pass it and they'll return for a final vote on the full plan on August 14, 5 days before students report for day 1 of blended learning in the Douglas County District. Cutting it close is standard practice these days as school boards and superintendents try to figure out the fine points of reopening plans that meet the expectations of families, staff, state education officials, and public health districts in the midst of a global pandemic that doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. And as Monticello District Chief Vic Zimmerman writes in a guest column on page B2, 850 school districts in Illinois equals close to 850 different return-to-school plans for 2020-2021. Around here, most include a remote learning component, either optional or the only offering available. But they vary widely on how many days a week students will be physically present in school buildings. Here's just a sampling. 5 days, not full days, mind you, but ones with on-site instruction ending at 12:30 p.m. Unity Junior High and High School, 1, Paxton's Clara Peterson Elementary, 117, Arthur Lovington Atwood Hammond High, and 2, Bement. 4 days. That's the plan in Fisher and Gibson City, Melvin Sibley, among the many districts adopting blended models. In their case, ones that call for students learning remotely on Wednesdays and attending classes the traditional way the rest of the week. 3 days. The every other week schedule for St. Joseph Ogden High students, who will be divvied up into 2 groups, maroon and Columbia blue after the Spartan colors, with only half on campus at any given time, alternating between 2 and 3 day weeks. 2 days. Among the districts where students will learn remotely 3 days a week, Urbana, Villa Grove, and Prairie View Ogden. It's also the in-school plan for 6th through 12th graders at Muhammad Seymour, where parents have finished choosing between it and the all-remote option, and scheduling is about to begin, Superintendent Lindsay Hall says. 0 days. While many Champaign School District students will spend their days in its virtual academy, Georgetown Ridge Farm officials this week adopted a full-fledged remote plan for all. The decision was a difficult one, Superintendent Jean Neal says, but in the end, a conservative approach focused upon staff and students' safety seemed the best choice at this time. That article by Jeff D'Alessio. From the Our County section, Bird's Eye View, Royal. Staff writer Anthony Zillis took his drone to Royal on Tuesday for a high-in-the-sky tour of the village. Loyal Eastern Illinois baseball fans still showing up, by Anthony Zillis. When it rains on Saturday night or Sunday morning, Royal Giants baseball coach Tim Dillman knows the texts will flood in front. It will flood in from loyal fans of the Eastern Illinois Baseball League team asking if that week's game is still on. We have some loyal fans, local fans, that never miss a game, Dillman said. If they're not there, I think they're sick and I worry about them. I look down the line and there's the same Freemans and Harpers and Fransons and Albers and Cribbets. The Giants may not play in Royal anymore after their field was raised in the 1980s when the team went on hiatus, but they still have a home base in the town. In Freeman Tavern, the walls are lined with photos from teams across the decades. Even this summer, those fans have shown up to watch the Giants win all 6 of their games during a truncated regular season to clinch the number 1 seed in the playoffs. They bring their little grills and they're there for the day, and they bring their lawn chairs, Dillman said. They've always spread out anyway. They back their truck up along the first baseline or the third baseline, and they spread their grill out and cook their burgers or chicken and watch baseball all day. We have a great following for Royal Baseball. Jay Simpson, My Take. Tattoos mark my identity. Tattoos are a part of my culture. Growing up, all my childhood idols had them, so of course I wanted them. LeBron James was my biggest influence. Seeing all of his tattoos and the swagger he had on the court was the icing on the cake for me. I had to get some. I remember getting my first one in the 8th grade. I was 14 years old, and nobody could tell me anything. A friend of mine knew a person doing tattoos for $30, right out of his Champagne kitchen, so I saved my money until I had enough to get one. The day finally came, and boy, was I nervous. I had to question myself a few times, like, are you sure you're ready for this? But when I thought about LeBron and how I knew he wouldn't chicken out, I went with it. The next day at school, I cut the sleeve off my shirt so everybody in school could see my new tat, a basketball hoop on my right shoulder. All of my friends loved it and wanted to know if it hurt. Of course, I told them, it didn't. Even though I might have dropped a tear or two in the process, they didn't need to know that. After all the attention I got after I got my first one, I went on a spree. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, I had my right arm almost fully covered with tattoos. A few of my favorites, which I dedicated to family, are all on the same arm. They are both of my kids' names and a picture of my Purdue jersey. They mean the most to me because my children are who I live and work hard for, and basketball is my first love. Now that I'm an adult, I do regret getting some of the tattoos because they don't have a deep enough meaning, and some of them are bad quality. I was young and in a rush to be like who I looked up to. I don't think I'll ever get any more, but I will get some of the not-so-good ones fixed. My kids see my tattoos and often ask questions about them and say that they want one. I know there is going to be a time when they are of age and able to make their own decisions, so my advice to them will be to make sure that everything they get has a meaning behind it and that it's everything they imagined it being, because it will be on you for the rest of your life. Opinion, Jim Day. How reprehensible was Chicago Cop? $540,000 worth. Chicago Police Sergeant Lawrence Knaziak, court records show, enjoyed insulting an underling with remarks about the officer's Jewish and German ancestry. Although the officer pleaded with Knaziak to stop the harassment, Knaziak never let up, states a recent opinion from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. Eventually, Officer Detlef Sommerfeld filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Knaziak that outlined a variety of discrimination claims. Just a standard discrimination lawsuit, right? It might have seemed that way in the beginning, but certainly not at the end. After hearing the case, a jury in 2014 awarded Sommerfeld $0 in compensatory damages, but $540,000 in punitive damages. The judgment raises a variety of questions. Can a jury award zero in actual damages, but a small fortune in punitive damages? How much are ugly name-calling and insults worth, and why? Is it within the realm of legal reason to order a defendant who claims a small or negative net worth to pay such a large judgment? The Federal Appeals Court, in an opinion written by Justice Diane Wood, last week answered all those questions in Sommerfeld's favor, the message being that those who engage in ugly behavior can face severe consequences. Just how shabbily did Knaziak treat Sommerfeld? The justices characterized the conduct as vicious anti-Semitic abuse, but refused to go any further. We prefer not to debase this opinion by repeating what Knaziak said. Suffice it to say that the vitriol invoked Hitler, the action the Nazis took in the death camps, and regret that Jews today live in the United States, Wood wrote in an opinion joined by fellow justices Joel Flom and Kenneth Ripple. In reading the opinion, one cannot help but sympathize for the plight of Knaziak's lawyer. He was literally defending the indefensible by invoking narrow legal arguments. Citing case law, Knaziak's lawyer argued that awarding $540,000 in damages is excessive because his client's verbal abuse of Sommerfeld did not rise to the very top of what courts call the hierarchy of reprehensibility. The principle reflects the accepted view that some wrongs are more blameworthy than others, the court states. Knasiak argued that mere verbal harassment is insufficient to justify $540,000 in punitive damages because it didn't reflect the apex of awfulness. After all, Knasiak's lawyers argued that his client never engaged in violence against Summerfield. But the appeals court said the law's hierarchy of reprehensibility is not rigid, that a degree of reprehensibility is the most important indicium of the reasonableness of a punitive damages award. On top of that, the appeals court said, while Knasiak's conduct could have been even worse, it was still extremely reprehensible, enough to justify the jury's award. Superficially, Knasiak's best argument, perhaps least worst, is a more fitting description, appeared to be that the jury erred by awarding significant punitive damages but no actual damages. The awards, after all, appear inconsistent. But the appeals court quickly dispensed with that claim. Punitive damages awards are not conditioned upon the presence of compensatory damages, Wood wrote. The jury's award of punitive damages without compensatory damages is thus not suspect, at least not on that basis. Finally, Knasiak argued that he simply cannot afford to pay the damages that were awarded, that they represent financial ruin for him, even though he has a pension of roughly $50,000 a year. Knasiak is now retired. He has indicated that he works only sporadically and that he has a mortgage, medical bills, unpaid by insurance, and a negative net worth, Wood's opinion states. Too bad, said the court. It ruled that sanctions should be based on the wrong done rather than on the status of the defendant. Just as Knasiak showed little sympathy for Summerfield, so too did the appellate court for Knasiak. If Knasiak is or becomes insolvent, his remedy is bankruptcy, which ensures that all creditors receive their contractual and statutory due, rather than leaving one unpaid, Wood wrote. Area history. In 2005, Marlene Boyer Johnson spent one hot week in New York City as Marilyn Monroe's guest 50 years ago. She's never been back since. It wouldn't be the same, says Johnson, who was 20 in 1955 when the actress traveled to Central Illinois and named her runner-up as Bement's Centennial Queen. The winner was her best friend Eileen Foran Rogers, and both of them accompanied Monroe back to New York, along with Bement native Carlton Smith, founder of the National Endowment for the Arts. Smith has since died. In 1962, Monroe committed suicide, and a few years previous, the Centennial Queen passed away. But Johnson was going strong and would be part of Bement's 150th birthday celebration, which had just started. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated Wednesday, July 29, 2020. Please stay tuned.